Plock, and you're listening to WMPG Gorham, Portland. WMPG is on the air thanks to donations from our listeners and through grant support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB promotes the growth and development of public media in communities throughout America. Online at cpb.org. The topics, views, and opinions on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WMPG, USM, or the University of Maine system. WMPG encourages the expression of opposing views. Stay tuned for Outcast.
Growing in numbers.
Good day from Outcast, a forum about LGBTQ plus lives and the issues that matter to our diverse community. Broadcast in collaboration with WMPG Community Radio in Portland and WERU Community Radio in East Orland. This is Tamara Torres McGovern. I use the pronouns she, her, hers. My co-host Marvin Ellison and I want to welcome you to Queer Spirit, a series of conversations on Outcast, in which we explore queer life and the power of the sacred.
And this is Marvin. I use the pronouns he and his, and I have the pleasure of introducing today's guest. Joining us today is Chris Davis, who grew up in Bangor and is a relatively recent arrival in Portland. She attends college as an adult learner and works part-time while also parenting two young adults from a distance, one of whom identifies as transgender. In recent years, Chris has been engaged in her own coming out as lesbian, coming out from a heterosexual marriage, and coming out from membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And if that isn't enough, Chris is also soon to be out as a published author. She's contributed an essay to a collection by ex-Mormon LGBTQ folks entitled, I Spoke to You with Silence, to be published by the University of Utah Press. The title of Chris's chapter is Five Reasons Why I Didn't Belong. Chris Davis, welcome to Queer Spirit on Outcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Chris, if you would, tell us about the Mormon tradition that shaped you and maybe something about how you identify these days. Do you think of yourself as Mormon still, or more as an ex-Mormon, or as something else entirely?
I identify as an ex-Mormon first, and I'd like to say also that I have a great deal of respect for members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and for their devotion to what they believe is true and right, and I mean no disrespect by anything I say today. I consider myself an ex-Mormon. I left the church 3 years ago, but my spirituality is defined differently now than it was when I was in the church. When I was in the church, the definition of, or the definition of being spiritual and righteous was your performances of, you know, how many prayers you said and how much you read the scriptures and how much service you did, if you went to church every week, if you fulfilled your assignments and went to the temple, just a lot of performances. But now my spirituality is very much within myself and coming from myself, kind of a fountain from within.
I love that language, a fountain from within. One of the stories you've written about is about being baptized at age 9, even though you had told the church leadership that you wanted to wait until you were much older before taking that step. Could you tell us what happened and why you wrote that once the deed was done? You felt that, quote, I had to remain loyal and faithful to the Mormon Church because of the obedience I had promised at my baptism?
I'd like to know what happened too. I'd like to understand exactly how I came to be baptized. I don't know if the bishop just went ahead and told my mom that I wanted to be baptized. I don't know if my mom insisted that I be baptized despite my objections. I'm not sure what happened there. But I know that I was held accountable for that decision, whether I made it or not. I was accountable because I had participated in the performance of my own baptism as a symbol of obedience and following Jesus and wanting to be a member of his church. I performed that. Whether I understood what it was or not didn't apparently matter. And children are usually baptized at 8, and I don't know any 8-year-olds, and I've raised 2 of them, who understand an eternal commitment at age 8. It's common practice also for Mormons to be expected to accept obligations and responsibilities and covenants without fully understanding what they mean at the time. I was told that I had already made the commitment, and so this is a little sticky, but I personally feel like that was a form of brainwashing and gaslighting and just saying, this is something you already agreed to. You promised. You have to fulfill this commitment or your eternal soul is in peril. And I couldn't go against that.
Yeah, that would be a lot to go against. Certainly, you know, Chris, you've also written, about how you suspected from a rather early age, maybe as early as 7, that you were somehow different. But that for the longest time, it wasn't safe to admit that to yourself or to others. And, you know, you described yourself in your essay this way. You wrote, on the outside, I looked like a contented housewife and mother of 2, but my secret truth was deep and dark and heavy. I trusted the church's advice to get married despite my inclinations, hoping that things would work out for the best. I trusted that my urges would become correct and appropriate after marriage. I tried with all my heart and soul to make that come true. I am left bruised and bloody from the effort. So, who and what has helped you, Chris, along the way to find and speak your truth? And perhaps maybe you could even tell us a bit about how your son's coming out as trans has been connected to your own.
First of all, I'd like to say that I put my trust, and that's why I got married, because I put my trust in an organization that used it inappropriately. I've had quite a few friends and groups that have given me support and helped me make this transition. One of the groups is the Triangle Community Center in Norwalk, Connecticut. They received me when I first came out in January of 2020. And then I learned about the UCC group here, the care group, LGBTQ care group, where I've met quite a few friends who are a tremendous support to me. And I had a couple of high school friends who turns out were gay too. And so we've supported one another and they've welcomed me to the community and helped me feel comfortable with myself. And I had a professor in a philosophy class for which I wrote this essay to begin with, who encouraged me and, you know, taught me how to express myself in an eloquent way, in a way that would be received well from an audience. My son, Chase, identifies as transmasculine. He came out to me when he was 15. He's 19 now. When he came out to me, I decided that I knew it was coming. He had been testing me for a couple of weeks and asking, well, what if, you know, one of my friends was, you know, and so when he came out to me, I decided to come out to him. And I told him that I was a closeted lesbian, and he was shocked. And from that moment on, we supported one another, and we went to, you know, the bishop called us into the office and said, let's manage expectations early, and said some very mean things that are mostly documented in the essay, and just sent a message of exclusion to us. And so I took Chase out of the church, and I said, we're never going back. I said, the church is not true, like Santa Claus. And Chase has really helped me learn how to love myself, not in spite of who I am, but because of who I am. That's been so valuable, and we are so close because of it.
What a beautiful way to have your paths intersect and your truths intersect. In case you're just tuning in, this is Queer Spirit on Outcast, and our guest today is lesbian survivor and author Chris Davis. Although being both a queer person and a spiritual person seem basic to your identity today, that hasn't always been the case, has it? Talk more about this journey of yours, if you would, including growing up in Bangor in the early 1980s and being in school at the same time as the young men, boys really, who murdered Charlie Howard by throwing him off a bridge into the Kenduskeag stream. How did this death affect you?
It was really scary for me. I was 13 at the time and just beginning my budding sexuality and really coming into my own in the very early stages. And I did not dare to come out already, but to see how people reacted to Charlie Howard's death and how the boys that I went to school with, how they were treated as heroes and really applauded and looked up to and just revered by my peers and by my family. I remember a lot of jokes about the Chequaqueer Bridge and just about the the humor, that the dark, dangerous humor that it was treated with was very scary to me and to my other friends I found out from high school who were not out yet as well, who were about my same age. Being being closeted queer in the early 80s, through the 80s, through the late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s. Please forgive me here. AIDS was really prevalent, and there was a lot of fear around that. And I've been told by some of my family, one of my family members, that the Charlie Howard thing was about AIDS and not about him being gay, but I don't know about that.
Yeah. So there was a lot of death and fear to have to contend with. And, you know, Chris, you're a brave soul. You're also very brave and I think generous because you've also written about how you yourself at one point were considering suicide as a way to escape from a life that so many deemed unacceptable. You know, I know you've connected with, for example, the Pride and Joy Foundation. And are invested in teen suicide prevention, especially for at-risk queer youth. Could you share what you've learned from your own life experience about these matters?
Yeah, first I'd like to say the Pride and Joy Foundation is an essential resource that I hope grows throughout the community. It's based in Arizona right now, but Elena Joy Thurston is in charge of that, and she is an ex-Mormon, and just her existence is a beacon of hope, and she's a good friend now, and we, you know, she inspires me a great deal, and she is dealing with, she is assisting families in welcoming queer members of their families and helping them start conversations that are very difficult. I've been in leadership positions in the church over the young women, over the youth group, and I was a little bit rebellious in saying things like, well, if you choose to get married and if you are blessed with children or if you choose to have children and things like that, and that's mild sedition in the Mormon church, but I wanted to make sure that the girls knew that if they didn't fit the classic mold, that it was okay and that it was their choice. I really wanted to hammer that home to them. I would have to say that mentors saved my life. Mentors in the church, teachers at school, just aunts and uncles, just people who reached out to me and told me that they loved me and that I was valuable to them. That was life-changing. And I think we can all make a difference in someone's life in that way, especially with youth. And the advice that I would give is that it does get better.
Thank you, Chris. We are living in tumultuous times. I'm curious, what is troubling your spirit these days? And similarly, what is feeding your spirit at this time?
The thing that's troubling me the most is the political divide. There's so much hate, and it really bothers me. My own mother was more upset that I might be a Democrat than that I left the church and came out as gay. So there's a great division in our country that it upsets me. And of course, the Black Lives Matters and social issues that I'm trying to educate myself about so that I don't make errors in ignorance. But the ways that I feed my soul are through meditation. I'm kind of new to it, but I'm really enjoying it and finding it very grounding and centering, as well as reading books that are inspirational to me, spiritual books. Right now I'm reading a couple of books by Pema Chodron, who's a Buddhist teacher. But I really enjoy exploring the spiritual. It feeds me. Finally, I'm finding some healing so that I can return to spirituality.
That's so good to hear. And, you know, Chris, as I listen to you and you speak about the number of people in your life who made a difference, who held you up and encouraged you to live and claim a full life, it just reminds me that coming out is really coming into community and a network of love and support. I'm just grateful that you're part of this broad community. You know, at the close of your essay, you write these words: "With each passing month, I celebrate my new freedom to think for myself and to experience life on more authentic terms. It is a fresh beginning, and I feel excited to embark on this new adventure." You know, Chris, I hear in your story struggle and challenge and setbacks, but also I hear about this clear thread of courage, perseverance, and hope. Could you tell us just for a minute what makes hope possible for you? Where does that resiliency come from?
I was without hope for many years while I was in the church and while I was raising my young family that I didn't feel qualified to be in. But now in order to keep my hope and resiliency alive, I do performances you know, the meditation that I said before, and also rituals of self-care, like journaling, exercising, eating well, also reaching out to friends. I have a whole list of things that I do in order to, I call them expressions of hope. It's just things that I can physically do to show myself that I have hope for the present and for the future.
Chris, you've spoken about writing as one of the ways you have found healing, empowerment, and even authenticity on this journey. I wonder if you might be willing to read to us a passage of your work where you maybe do some exploring of this history in the Mormon Church and about your own reflections and finding your truth.
I'd be happy to. This is about when I was a missionary in California. I was exposed to misogyny as a girl growing up in Maine. I was accustomed to jokes about female drivers and subtle comments about a woman's place in the world. But until becoming a missionary in the male-dominated field of proselyting for the church, I had never experienced this level of discrimination and forced submission. Even our mission president, who leads the 200 missionaries in the greater San Jose area, 220 of whom are women, 20 of whom are women, recently told us how much he hated having sisters in his mission. He said we were more trouble than we were worth, and that if he had his way, he would send us all home. I call my mother from our apartment, which is against the mission rules. I want to come home. This is all bullshit. I am angry and desperate for compassion and understanding. My mother panics. She does not want me to return from my mission early because of the shame and embarrassment it would cause our family in front of her church friends. There is a stigma of failure for missionaries who return early. She begs me to stay. please, Christy, just do whatever you have to do to finish this last year of your 18-month mission. I really need you to stay. My mother has sacrificed so much for me. After the church insisted that I empty my savings account to cover mission expenses, my mother took up the remainder of the cost, which totaled in the thousands of dollars. She regularly writes me letters of encouragement and sends packages of my favorite goodies to remind me of home. She has been a rock of support, and all she is asking me to do is endure until the end of my mission. I can do that for her. I dig deep into my studies and recommit to my mission service out of respect for my mother and out of obedience to my church leadership. I teach myself to sublimate my own desires and aspirations for the church and my family. I convince myself that what I want is not as important as the success of my community. These mental gymnastics change me forever. I assimilate into the Borg collective, to reference Star Trek, meaning I have adopted a hive mentality. My willingness to think independently is muted. I finish my mission and return home to look for a husband and start a family.
Yeah. So any sort of last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners? Any queer wisdom that you haven't had a chance to add today?
I would say to be true to yourself, even though it may hurt the people you love the most. It's not worth it to live a life for somebody else. You are the star of your own play, and you know, get on that stage and be the main actor. I would say let love be your motivation and act out of love, behave out of love. That's the only way that I have found peace.
That's such a good note to end on, Chris. Thank you, Chris Davis, for this conversation and for being with us today. This is Marvin Ellison with my co-host Tamara Torres McGovern, and you've been listening to Queer Spirit, a series of conversations exploring queer life and the power of the sacred.
We appreciate people who go to our Facebook page, Outcast Maine, and leave comments and suggestions. You can also leave comments and suggestions at wmpg.org. And you can email us at outcastmaine@gmail.com. You've been listening to Outcast on WMPG 90.9 FM, community radio at USM. Stay tuned for Lanyap. And remember, you are all made of stars.
I'm Eve Karobu. I'm the lead and co-founder of Batimbo United. I'd like to invite all of you guys to this event, Tales, Bells, and Drums.
On September 4th, promise you guys, join us, and you will feel the joy that you never felt before.
Co-sponsored by WMPG. Tales of Bells and Drums is at Merrill Auditorium in Portland on September 4th, 5:30 to 7:30. For more information and tickets, go to porttix.com. Look up Tales of Bells and Drums. We are so excited to see you there. Hey.
Lovey.
I'm Nancy.
I'm Heather.
And I'm Julie. Views and opinions on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those.